Hey everyone, welcome back after our short mid-program summer-ish break. For those of you in the UK, it's like not even summer, it's just pretending we're having very autumnal, rainy weather. But really good to see you all back. Excited to talk to you today about The Protector, and jump back into our program. Please know the chat is very much open. Feel free to participate in there, and we'll do a kind of an interactive approach to today's call. So yeah, shall we jump in? I've got some slides for you. Here we go. So today's call, what we're going to talk about. Talk a little bit about the aims of this module and really about going beyond what you may know as the inner critic, like what that, why we want to do that and what that looks like and feels like. And we'll talk more about the protector, which is, in case it's not clear, this is the way that I characterize self-doubt. So we will dive into this in quite a bit of detail today. If you have had a chance to look at the videos associated with Module 6, great. If not, equally great. And we'll cover some of those aspects today. And next week as well. So we're going to talk about, in this week, we're going to talk more about the actual protector and the different patterns that I've seen show up. With hundreds of different clients. And then next week, we'll talk more about how to intervene. Like, once you've actually kind of been able to understand and name the protector with your client, with yourself, next week, we're going to talk more about how to coach with that, how to take it beyond just understanding what kind of pattern we're talking about and how to intervene in a really effective way. Not all interventions are the same, which you'll already know if you've had a look at the workbook. But yeah, so I'm hoping that this week will prove to be super helpful and just expand your understanding of what we mean by self-doubt as we take this further. So you may know about these things. This a self-saboteur. The inner critic, lizard brain, right? This idea that we have this kind of very old reptilian part of our deep ancestry that kind of is worried about saber-toothed tigers. For some reason, the saber-toothed tiger always comes up when we're talking about this kind of thing. Limiting beliefs is another way of characterizing self-doubt. Have you all heard of these concepts in past coach training? You may have had lots of kind of education around how to deal with these concepts, however they've been named. Mostly the interventions that we are taught, certainly in coach training and in a lot of therapy training. I'm not sure clear if counseling is the same, but the sort of agreed approach is to either demonize this part of us, infantilize it, ignore it, or befriend it. Do those interventions sound kind of familiar to you all? Yeah. And I mean, I've been given everything from, turn it into a little creature and give it a funny name. So I used to have this kind of slightly dragony, dwarfy kind of creature called Barbara. And that was meant to help me kind of demonize this inner critic part of me that we're all universally apparently have. And that was a sort of creative approach, I guess, to sorting out this part of us. And I don't know about you, I've always found this kind of approach really problematic. This for me, this began because when I was first told about the self-saboteur when I started my first coach training. We talked about this inner voice, right? This inner voice that was kind of mean and was meant to tell us all things, horrible things about ourselves. And I never had that. I've never had that voice. Lots of people don't. Many people do, but a lot of people don't. So I never quite gelled with that. And as I sort of got further and interested in coaching and then ended up following my own research path, I found that a lot of these assumptions are rooted in very kind of old, almost, I think even Freud was the first person to sort of come up with the idea of what we now know to be the inner critic. So quite, very early d days understanding of, how our psyches actually work. But it assumes that there is a part of us that is broken, faulty, trying to get in the way of our dreams and goals. And that seemed to me to be slightly problematic on a number of levels, particularly when I became more and more trauma-informed. I was like, well, there's really bloody good reasons why we may have internalized perhaps the voice of a critical parent to keep, it's like, oh, if I can preempt that, I can keep myself safe. So it seemed to me to be quite patronizing to the client to, turn this into a little dragon called Barbara. It felt kind of icky to me. But also, I think what I've come to really believe, and what I'm hoping we're going to talk more about today, is that when we do this, when we demonize or infantilize or ignore or seek to kind of separate ourselves from our self-doubt, from however that shows up, we rob ourselves of the opportunity to understand why it's there in the first place. We rob ourselves of this immensely powerful self-knowledge. And, for our clients, we steal that from them. As soon as we're diverting them off into doing something else, we're kind of robbing them of that opportunity as well. So to me, to very consciously and consistently characterize self-doubt as the protector is a way of saying, this is what it's doing. It's trying to protect you. It's trying to preserve your sense of belonging and acceptance, safety, and sometimes survival. Right? So for me, being able to really look at your self-doubt, not run away from it, try and avoid it, try and overcome it, but to actually go into it and see what it is there to teach us about ourselves, about our lovely clients, you get to actually see through what that protection is all about into the doorway of, real deep self-knowledge and healing and really great liberating things, right? When you can actually go, oh, this is my protective self-doubt coming up, and I can take care of myself. I have more resources to take care of myself. Then we're not trying to avoid circumstances where self-doubt might come up. Instead, we're like, whatever happens, I've got me. Yeah. So I just want to pause and check in with you all there, because basically what I'm saying is, hey, you know all that stuff that we've been taught in coaching school about how to work with these concepts of, the inner critic, the lizard brain, the limiting beliefs. I think we should park a lot of that and look at a different way of doing this. I want us to go beyond this idea of the inner critic and actually support our clients to understand themselves, because I think that understanding is the doorway to healing and to really feeling really deeply resourced no matter what happens. So I just want to check in. What's coming up for you? Is this like, great, I'm so here for this? Or are you like, well, yes, but there is a lizard brain. I'm totally here for it. So
quick question about the lizard brain, because it never occurred to me that that was on that that fell into the same list as Inner Critic and Self-Saboteur. Is it true that there is a part of our brain that cannot physiologically or physically distinguish between an actual risk like falling, saber-toothed tiger? Because my experience of doing a trapeze workshop physically felt the exact same as conflict in a situation. So is that lizard brain, or is that more physical, like the inability of your body to tell the difference?
So it's a fantastic question. What I understand is that yes, we have physiological responses to stress. The research tells us that there are two fears that we have as infants: loud noises and falling. They're the two actual threats that we instinctively respond to as infants. Everything else we kind of learn along the way, right? So, yes, I mean, and this is the thing, right? Yes, of course there are physical threats, absolutely, but actually we have evolved past that, and our brain will respond in these four different ways: flight, fight, freeze, and fawn. And they map to the four different patterns of the self-doubt, protective self-doubt. So we can use that as a way forward. But think about your clients. When your clients are rocking up to you, they've got protective beliefs, right? And that results in protective behaviors, but very rarely are they in physical danger, and that is a coaching issue, if that makes sense.
It does. But so where does the physical sensation that to me is indistinguishable between marketing my coaching practice and jumping off something very high? I'd sort of in my head, I thought it was the lizard brain that made the body feel the exact same sensation. So I suppose that's my confusion.
Well, our brains, whether it is a lizard brain or not, I mean, you know, this is the amygdala, is what we're talking about, is what people call the lizard brain. That is what holds on to our stress response, right? So it comes from the same place.
Okay, thank you.
So
That makes sense.
yeah, so the lizard brain, I'm not, and all of these things can exist, right? We're not saying that none of them exist. What I'm saying is, I think we need better, more effective coaching tools to be able to support our clients rather than demonizing, infantilizing, ignoring, and dismissing.
Great. Thank
Yeah.
you.
So yeah, and so we'll talk about that stress response and how that maps to the four patterns. So you can kind of see how this shows up. But you're absolutely right. Like, our somatic response is kind of the same. And this is the thing that I just find astonishing, is if you're having a somatic response, it feels utterly legitimate. So the thing to not do is then say there is something wrong with you, or you need to say, oh, it's just Barbara the gremlin who is doing this to me, right? What we actually want to do is say, hey, what's going on right now? You know, can you breathe? Can you be here? And stay with that, with the client.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I was struck when you were talking about SAS, the like four common strategies that we're taught for how to deal with these different characterizations of self-doubt. I was like, oh, but befriend seems so lovely, you know? Especially in a world that's like demonized and cloister and all of these things. But as you were talking, I was thinking about how powerful it is to actually just approach everything from a place of neutrality. I was like, oh, it could feel really risky to a client to feel pressured in some way to befriend something that maybe like they feel is causing a disruption in their life or causing an outcome that they're struggling with. And so I appreciate how we're talking about like we're putting befriend in sort of this conversation, because I think just having an invitation to notice from a place of curiosity and calmness can be really helpful, and to not make people feel forced, like, oh, you have to befriend this thing. Maybe you will, but that's not actually a requirement to get to know how it's functioning or showing up in your life.
Yeah, I completely resonate with that. And I think, you know, I've seen like a lot of stuff that comes out from, you know, just coaching Planet Coach, right? Is, you know, hold hands with your fear and stuff like this. And I think, actually, if your fear has come from like a, you know, some kind of trauma, and someone says hold hands with it, I actually think that's a bit irresponsible in lots of ways. And again, it just feels patronizing. Our clients are freaking smart, right? They know this is scary. And what we don't want to do is exactly what you're describing, like the pressure, right? To have our clients embrace something that they don't want to embrace. They actually, the kind of almost universal response to anything like this, when self-doubt comes up, the discomfort it creates, I would say 90% of us want to run for the hills. We're just like, I just want this away from me. That's why we engage in all these kind of resistance behaviors. We're like, I'll go procrastinate. That's way easier than dealing with this, you know, or I'll numb out in some way, or I'll just wait, however we manage it. So to then say, hey, well, I want you to hold hands with your fear. It's like, you're creating a scenario that is at odds with the energy of the client almost always in my experience. And this is the thing, you know, I want you to all feel like, oh, I'm totally equipped. Like when a client brings something that they maybe even feel some shame around, or some embarrassment, or a lot of activation somatically around something, it's like when you feel like it's okay, it's all good. This is your protector. It's totally cool. Let's have a look at what's showing up here, and we can find some ways for you to move through that. You know, it's not something that we need to be afraid of, or avoid. You know, we can play with this, and it's going to be okay. It's like the relief, you know, the relief from clients, just to know that this is normal, and there is, you know, a name for it is often the best response. You know. Yeah. Anyone else want to share anything about this idea of moving into protection rather than anything else? Hi, Hannah.
Hey, yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense, and yeah, not to try and make you more at odds with yourself, make things more of a fight, but I'm just curious, I don't really have a fully formed question, this is what's in my head, is like, you know, you hear about the difference between the conscious and the subconscious mind, and like how this interplays with those two things.
Yeah. Just to riff on that a little bit, and there wasn't a question, so I'm just going to talk a little bit about this. In my experience, and the research tells us this too, which I think is reassuring, most of our protective beliefs hover somewhere in between conscious and unconscious. So we may not actually be fully aware of, this is the belief that is driving my response, right? So we just feel like, you know, I'm in the stress response, or I'm, you know, feel like I'm sabotaging myself, however our clients might describe it. But they may not be aware of what's actually going on. And there's good reason for that. Our thinking minds are incredibly efficient, right? They just want to get to the thing the fastest. That's why we have neural pathways that we just keep going over and over and over. It's like, that's the fastest way to make sense of things. So it's one of the reasons why when we look at kind of changing protective beliefs, uncovering protective beliefs, we do that quite slowly. We consciously like bringing some of the stuff up for the client so they can see what's going on. So we're taking it step by step and looking at, you know, what is happening here? Letting the client feel safe to look at this stuff rather than kind of rush through it or just get to the part where they can, you know, move out of discomfort sort of thing. So yes, conscious and unconscious processes are going on all the time. Particularly when it comes to that feeling of threat or risk, our brains want us to respond very quickly. Right? So it takes some can take some practice to sort of support our clients to feel safe enough just to slow down and see what's actually happening here. Often it's just a kind of response, and you know, the idea is to just get out of the situation as quickly as possible through that fight, flight, freeze, fawn kind of response. I don't know if that illuminates anything, Hannah, or if that helps.
Yeah, it was just like a general, but yeah, it makes sense because yeah, the client's probably like, oh, I can recognize the behaviors, I can tell I'm putting something off, or I can tell what I'm doing, like that's easier to spot. But yeah, like uncovering what's actually going on is the, you know, the trickier part.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, for us too, we can sometimes just have a response and go, what the heck was that about? You know, don't really even know, it surprises me that I did that, or I'm not sure where that's coming from. And usually it's coming from us. It's just we're not kind of, you know, sure about what the origin story is. So we have to do a little bit of uncovering. Cool. So let's have a little look at how the protector works, and then we'll talk more about these four kind of patterns. So, and this is just a sort of like crib sheet of things to just keep in mind, right? So the protector, our self-doubt, it's a composite of all the ways we've kept ourselves psychologically safe, right? All of the ways. So from infancy, since before we could talk, we've worked out how to stay psychologically safe, right? How to preserve safety, belonging, and acceptance. That's the primary kind of primary idea of what we're into when we're pre-verbal, and we just keep adding to those ways that we keep ourselves safe. We find out that if we giggle and smile as babies, we often get positive reinforcement back, and that feels really good, and it creates oxytocin. And so, you know, all of those kinds of processes are involved here. And then as we get older and we, you know, find that we connect with other humans in preschool and then school with teachers, as we age through our teenage years, you know, our employers, our lovers, our friends as adults, the PTA, right? We figure out, how do I belong here? Who do I need to be to belong? What are the ways to stay safe here? And over time, we can find that we end up developing sometimes quite functional approaches, but at some point there'll be a point where the sort of limit of that is discovered, and it's often in conflict with something we want to create for ourselves, right? And so we're often in this place of, oh, I know I need to change my approach, but that doesn't feel safe. I don't know who I will be if I do that. Yeah. So I will often say to people in my courses, and you know, as a coach when I'm working with the muggles, you know, all your self-doubt tells me, it doesn't tell me anything about your capability or your destiny. All it tells me is that you've found excellent ways to keep yourself safe. That's the only thing it can tell me about you, right? And that can be incredibly supportive for a client who's like, there's something wrong with me. Maybe you've just found really great ways to keep yourself safe. Yeah. Second thing the protector is all about is remembering those past hurts, right? So it uses the past as a reference point for any present risk, right? So this has an echo of a past hurt, I'm going to create some discomfort so you hold yourself back. Yeah. So in it, I think this can help explain things like if you've had a person criticize you as a young person, as a child even, when you and I work with a few people who are quite creative, right, who were told that they weren't very good at something, or they made a mess when they were being creative. And it's almost like, well, I'm not going to put myself at risk of that, even if I have an urge to create, or I'm going to do it in a really tidy way, or I'm never going to show anyone what I've created, right? There can be lots of different ways that we do this, but it's all about managing that risk, right? And at some point that will reach the kind of tension between who we want to be now and how we've learned to keep ourselves safe. But the protector is that part of our psyche that remembers those past hurts and is trying to warn us of the risk now. Yeah. It's always there for a bloody good reason, right? So we never experience self-doubt in a vacuum. Even if it can feel really surprising or out of the blue, there's always a good reason for it. It just may be, as Hannah points out, you know, a bit under the surface of our consciousness. Yeah, and sometimes we as coaches need to do a little bit of probing and reassure the client that it's going to be there for a good reason. We just might not know what that is right now. Right? It might feel like it's out of the blue. And it is often very sophisticated and quite sneaky. It's a sort of ecosystem of protection. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we look at these four key patterns that show up. I often think about how young children, you know, if you're pre-verbal and you're figuring out ways to preserve acceptance and belonging, even if you don't even know that that's what you're doing, like the sophistication of that is incredibly, you know, moving when you think about what we did as little people to stay safe in our families and you know, keep ourselves alive in our families. It's quite moving when you think about what we actually do to make sure we're okay. And it is always the doorway to self-belief, self-trust, self-acceptance, and self-worth, right? So once we figure out, oh, this is the protector showing up, this is the protective pattern that I'm in, it's the way to know yourself better, to understand how you're kind of locked into a bit of a pattern of protection and how you can break that. And then it's like, oh, well, actually, you know, I don't even know what's possible. If I can break this pattern, I don't know what's possible for me, you know, because I have this access to now to more resources, different opportunities to do things. So the sophisticated ecosystem of protection that I'm talking about, it's highly correlated to our survival instinct. So it's never going to go away. It's, in fact, it's possibly going to get a bit smarter, right? Because it's going to have to find more and different ways to hold you back as you get onto it. And so usually there is a little bit of a backlash, and then we will find that, you know, it starts to settle down as you're in that place of compassionately reassuring, often this younger part of you. It's okay, I've got this. It's all right. You know, we can make different choices. I used an example of this this morning in this morning's class. I was talking a couple of weeks ago with a woman who's in her 50s, who's in self-belief school, the group program that I have for muggles. And she's a graduate student in a social work degree, amazing human. And she brought to the group that she had found one of her professors was really mean and quite sarcastic. And all of her classes are on Zoom. And she said, you know, it's really tricky to ask questions. She and another student, they're one of the oldest in the group, everyone else is trying to be the kind of perfect student, and she's going, this is actually not okay, this professor is a bit of a dick really, and what should I do? And she sort of had this tension of, you know, I both am afraid of his authority and his ability to humiliate me in the class, which I've witnessed him do to others, and also I feel responsible for everybody else because, you know, I'm the old one and I should know better. And so we sort of looked at, you know, what she was asking for was, how can I resource my healthy adult self so I don't fall into those patterns of trying to be the best student or taking care of everybody else, right? They were the sort of protective patterns that she was very used to. And the class, you know, came up with lots of really cool and creative approaches to how she could show up here. And she reported back that what she'd actually done was brought out a quality that she has, which is her humour. And so she had bought a giant bag of cheese balls and she had sat and eaten those in the class while having a kind of, you know, private conversation, text conversation with the other student that was also a mature student in the class. And she was like, we do not have to listen to this guy. And she said it felt so powerful for her that she was able to, you know, use the metaphor of the cheese balls, but also feel like she didn't have to take care of everybody else, nor did she have to call this guy out. She was just taking care of herself. And that felt incredibly resourced for her. It was a new way of responding, right? And so that may not be her number one go-to all the time, but it's an experiment, right? To play with, what else could I do here? What other options do I have? And so this is what I mean by when we can actually sit in our self-doubt, see what's going on, recognize the pattern, then it sort of feels almost safer, I think, for our healthy adult self to come up with some creative resources for what else was possible, you know, how else you could intervene instead of falling into these patterns that feel like same old, yeah. So when we talk more about experiments and interventions and coaching around this next week, we'll be talking about this kind of thing. But the first step is to really kind of understand what those patterns are that are showing up for people. So let me just get us here. So let's... Yeah, so I just want to make sure I've got relevant slides here for you. So our kind of toolkit for coaching with the protector, and as I said, we'll go into this a bit more next week, is the first one is the meet your protector visualization. So just want to call this out for folks. In module 6, you'll see that there is a recording, an MP3 recording called Meet Your Protector. And there's also the script of that recording. And the reason I share the script is listen to the visualization. If you love it, and you may not, right? But if you love it and you think, oh, this would really help my clients, you can then tailor the script and record it for yourself and then give it to clients to listen to in between sessions, for example. The approach that I'm using in that visualization is called voice dialogue. And it's just an approach where you have the client talk to this part of themselves, right? So it's like we're sort of engaging in a relationship between different parts of the psyche, or a conversation with different parts of the psyche. Some clients absolutely love it. And they're like, holy crap, I can actually talk to this part of me. This is revelatory. Others are like, well, this is a bit weird. And, you know, I'm just me. How can I have parts of me? And it's totally okay, right? But I think it can be really helpful, and I wanted to include it in there as well as the script so that you can just make it your own and record it for your clients if that feels good to you. What we're going to do today is talk about these four patterns to identify and name these different protectors and understand a bit more about how and why it shows up. And then next week, we're going to talk more about transforming the client's relationship with their protector using different experiments, right? Intervening in specific ways. Yeah. So that's how we're kind of divvying the two sessions up and talking about coaching with the protector. And we come back to this again and again, right? So the protector is a sort of universal concept that comes up in the program, and we'll just keep talking about that. You'll get to know your client's protective patterns really intimately. It becomes a kind of shared language between us and between yourself and your clients if you choose to share that with them. Okay, so I just want to share with you the coaching model and kind of sort of identify what we're talking about here. So in the middle is the healthy adult self, right? And it's holding on to the protector, right? It's looking after the protector, which is there. So for each of the healthy adult self resources, self-belief, self-acceptance, self-worth, and self-trust, there is also a corresponding protector, right? So it's like the shadow of that that healthy self resource. So so self-belief has the critic, self-acceptance the martyr, self-worth has the scapegoat, and self-trust the bystander. So these are like the sort of shadow or inverse responses of the healthy adult self. That's where we find these four patterns, okay? And so for each of these, there are specific interventions and specific experiments that are really effective for working with them. But it's what we want to do is, how do we know that we're dealing with a martyr, right? So how do we know what we're actually talking about? That's what we're about to find out. Okay, so we start with the critic. And the critic is the shadow of self-belief. Its protective aim is to be perfect, right? And perfect looks different on different people. So for some, it might be, you know, be the perfect put together one, right? For others, it could be the perfect student, be the perfect employee, the perfect wife, mother, parent. Be the one who organizes all social events for the family, right? It's whatever version of perfect the client is bringing, you get to sort of get an insight into what feels like the protective aim for them. You'll recognize this protector because the way they are talking about this aim is critical, judgmental, or bullying, right? So that's how you kind of know that person is in that protective pattern. It's all driven by this core belief, I'm not good enough, right? And we hear this all the time, right? This is the kind of classic inner critic sort of characterization. But there is a really core distinction here, which, you know, in terms of like behaviors and the ways that we try to alleviate that belief, it's a constant need to prove, right? So constantly needing to aim for perfection, which, as we know, is, you know, impossible standard to meet. So overworking at whatever it is that is driving that sense of perfectionism, that's what you'll see in your client. Yeah. And know that the fear underneath all of this, the bit that's unconscious, is that the client doesn't want to lose control. They don't want to be criticized by others, and they don't want to feel too much. These are the things that are happening here underneath it all. So I wonder if that makes sense to you, if that's something you recognize in yourself or your clients, family members perhaps. Sometimes what can happen is this gets projected out as well, right? So it gets projected onto other people. So we're not just critical, judgmental, or bullying of ourselves, but of others who don't meet the standard that we've set for them. Anyone want to say anything about the critic? Is that something that you recognize or feel like, yeah, that's mine? Yeah, Hannah.
I just have a question, actually, because yeah. I watched this, but it didn't quite click. This is the same as the quiz. And that then the each of these four is then broken down into three other archetypes, right, in the quiz.
Yeah.
So do those three archetypes, is that just like a more in-depth? So there are like three that goes off from the critic, right? I just wanted to recap on that.
That's part, right, okay. Yeah. So I actually created the archetypes model first. And that was to look at the very kind of specific patterns of self-doubt, but they do sort of, they do scroll up, if you like, into a more of a meta theme. So like the just make sure I'm saying the right things. So the advocate, the conductor, and the designer are all aspects of that critic protector. They're the three archetypes associated with self-belief, or with that critic protector. So yes, they are. You could see the archetypes as more delineated patterns that tree up into that theme. Jane, did I see your hand go up as well?
Yeah, I definitely had the critic in my top two or three in the quiz. Uh-huh. Were the designer and the, like, there, I had a lot of them in that. And then, and I can see that in my control, like in the pod coaching, a lot of the like underlying beliefs and stuff really fit well with that. And then, but I vacillate between the critic and the bystander. So I can see actually from this explanation of like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it 100% right, or I'm not going to do it at all.
Yes. Oh my God. And isn't that so effective? Right. That keeps you safe because you're in all or nothing. Yeah. And it keeps you safe from something. I wonder even if you like have some insight into what that might be.
Yeah. Through the coaching and also doing the worksheets on my own, it's a lot of everything goes back to judgment or feeling judged or assuming I'm being judged or that like feeling of being attacked through judgment.
Yeah. So I just want to affirm, like, you have chosen the two protective patterns that will almost guarantee your ability to stay out of that, because you're judging yourself first, right? With the critic pattern, it's like, I'll get in there first so no one can hurt me. And with the bystander, it's like, I won't do anything, then no one can judge me, right? Mm-hmm. I'll just wait until I know enough. Yeah. So you have a really sophisticated protector there, Jane. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a really great point as well, that we all, if you think about this as the protector is sort of 100%, most of us would have a sort of ratio of something. Like for me, I think I probably have about 60% scapegoat and maybe, I can't do maths, so I'm going to end up with 150 here, but it's mostly scapegoat and critic with a decent chunk of martyr, but I'm not very bystander-y. I tend to get moving pretty quickly. But yeah, you may notice in yourselves that you have different protectors show up either in different contexts. So like in my business, if it's too complicated, my scapegoat just goes, it's too hard, I can't, and I kind of freak out for a bit. So it's interesting to notice sort of where particular patterns might show up in different aspects of your life. And maybe how intense they feel as well, depending on what feels like it's at stake. Yeah. Yeah. But that's a smashing combo, Jane. Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to share one other thing that I noticed as I guess a proving or a compensation for that. I did a lot of work in the last 5 years or so on developing intuition, and like all of my tools, how they relate to intuition is all about almost like overcoming that knowing enough. Like if I can't know enough from the world around me, then I'll do it through intuition. But then there's always that like wanting certainty even through intuition so that I can act, and seeing like how I chose what I chose, the paths, because of my protective beliefs and the tools that I developed and learning to overcome those. In that way, it's very interesting.
Well, and I also think, intuitively, it's a cracking approach to take, right? So for me, intuition sits within self-trust, which is the positive side of the bystander, right? So it was like amazingly brilliant of you to come up with, oh yes, there, if I can trust myself on some level, even though I hear you on the there's no such thing as certainty, but it's like great to see, oh yes, that is a way to intervene in that sense of I can't even know enough, is you actually kind of let go of needing to know everything and come back to intuitively, what do you know?
Yeah, but it can also go a dark direction. The shadow of intuition is like, well, unless I get like this really clear intuitive message of this is the way to go, then I stay in that bystander of like, well, I'll just keep waiting for that right insight before I'll act. So it's like it has...
Waiting for the sign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it still has its light and dark, even in trying to develop that.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I've actually found is that we need to, when it comes to the bystander, we need to go up to values, to self-belief, to really intervene. Like, what's the big picture here? Why would we do this? What's worth taking the punt, you know? See, but we'll talk about that in much more detail next week, but yeah, that's a great insight. Anyone else recognize themselves or recognize the critic as showing up as a pattern? Yeah. Yeah, Angela. Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice one to have in your back pocket, isn't it? Yeah, go for it, Angela.
I just wanted to share kind of a funny experience, but at first it really pissed me off. So I'm launching a project with my partner and it involves some products and a website, and we've had a lot of tech issues. And I just completely like lost it like 2 days ago. He was just like, I do not understand what's happening. And so what it ended up to be was I wanted things to be perfect. And he even said the words, if it's not perfect on the first round, it's going to be okay. And I just felt my whole body just go, no, it's actually not okay if it's not perfect. And so it was just observing myself going, okay, this is really showing up. But I also, we talked about it, and I'm so grateful I have a partner who's willing to explore this with me. But I recognize that this pattern shows up that makes it really hard to delegate and really hard to work with team members. And in this case, having my partner be my team member in this project, there was like that double whatever. But anyway, but it was just when he said those words, it's okay if it's not perfect, I had this visceral reaction. So I'm just really appreciating this conversation because it's helping me understand it even more.
Love the courage of wanting to work with your partner doing anything.
I'll let you know how it goes.
and it's interesting, isn't it? Like, I think often, and we'll talk about this when we get to conflict in a couple of modules time, but often some of the conflicts we experience can be down to our protective patterns. It's like, no, you don't understand, it has to be this way. And the other person's like, no, you don't understand, it's this way. Mm-hmm. And all we're both doing is trying to keep ourselves safe. Mm-hmm. So yeah, really fun times in your house right now, Angela. Love it. Cool. Okay, so we've got the critic. We've also got the martyr. This is the shadow of self-acceptance. And it's all about the protective aim here, be needed, right? Be needed at all costs. That's where safety is, right? If I'm needed, I'm safe. So what you end up sort of seeing in your client is that they, or yourself perhaps, we tend to dismiss our own needs so that we are available to other people. We rescue other people and we don't say no. So boundaries are often, you know, a loose idea rather than a way of living for folks who have this pattern. And it's driven by this core belief, I don't matter as much as you. Right? I don't matter as much as you. So my needs don't matter as much as yours. You know, what I want, what I feel, all of that kind of takes a back seat. So, you know, naturally you see this in overgiving. Right? Lack of boundaries, a lot of self-sacrifice, all of that. I think this is a very common one for those of us in the helping professions. We have that sort of innate wish to help folks, and it can easily tip over into a bit of a protective pattern, right? And underneath it all is that fear of being abandoned, being disliked, creating or being part of conflict, anything like that. So the thing to remember here is it's about where do we perceive safety, and that is in being needed. So in for the critic, it's about being perfect. So we do whatever we can to create that safety. And you see the same thing here with being needed. Yeah. Anyone recognize themselves as having a bit of a martyr pattern at times? Anyone who finds it hard to maybe delegate or is constantly volunteering for things that they don't actually want to do? Yeah, that's a sign of a martyr. It's interesting. This is across the board, and I was saying this morning because someone asked about it. There doesn't seem to be a delineation around gender, and there doesn't seem to be a delineation around popular archetypes or popular patterns. I've had over 6,000 people take the archetypes quiz, and there isn't one that pops up as the most popular. It's pretty even across the board, which I find fascinating. I'm like, oh, could not have planned that if I'd tried. So what you'll see often, and this is probably, I just want to couch this because it's most likely because of the men I've coached with have been in leadership positions, but the way that I see the martyr show up for men in leadership positions is that inability to delegate. Right, so they'll often be overworking and doing way more things and doing annoying things like doing other people's work for them because it's not up to the standard, right? So they're aware of it, but it's often that thing of I can't let this go. I've got to do it for them. Or if someone lets me down, I'll step in. I won't delegate this or delay anything, right? So you can see there are some complementary aspects to the martyr and the critic. These are both what I call over-functioning patterns. So we're very comfortable doing more, over-giving and overworking in the critic and the martyr. Yeah. Make sense? Yeah, Tina.
I was just going to say the connection I feel to the martyr is just pretty much the role of mother. Yeah. And just those competing priorities between, it's the evening, cooking dinner, being with your kids. Maybe I really want to work out, so that's like a conflict that I struggle with sometimes.
Totally. It's very, very connected. And I've taken or sort of been inspired by the Cartman's drama triangle, for those of you who are psychology nerds. And he talks about the rescuer, which the martyr is, sort of inspired by, as being the mother, and the persecutor, the critic, is the father. But I find that offensive and very outdated. And not actually that true. However, you're absolutely right that often, particularly for parents and mothers in particular, who have not found boundaries modeled in a way that doesn't make them feel like, oh, I'm just going to be a horrible person if I do this, then there is often that inner conflict where everyone else's needs are more important than mine. So if I do want to work out instead of cooking dinner, unless I can find a way to figure that out, I'll just end up doing that.
Yeah.
And it means that, the number one emotion associated with that kind of dynamic is resentment.
Yes.
Right? It's like, bugger this, but I'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a great way in. Like, when you've got a client who's, like, just resentful, and, for the critic, it's like if they're just burnt out, right? Because this is the fawn response, and the critic is the fight response. Right. And both of them, it's like you just think about what gets associated with that. It's, the critic, it's burnout. With the martyr, it's resentment. So that those over-functioning protective patterns, yeah, they can be exhausting for folks. Yeah, because you can't do enough to feel safe. That's not where safety comes from, right? So, yeah. Anyone else want to say anything about that martyr pattern? Oh, good. Okay, so let's move on to the scapegoat. This is the shadow of self-worth, right? And so here the safety comes from not trying, right? So the aim here is just don't try. If you try, bad shit happens, right? We'll often see, and I sometimes call this the adulting pattern, right? It's like adulting is just too damn hard, right? So you may see a client who feels like they're a bit chaotic, they feel helpless, sometimes ashamed, and it's driven by that core belief, it's just so much harder for me, it's too hard for me. And the core behaviors you see here are all to do with overwhelm. So they can often be looking for someone to rescue them, and because they feel dependent, it's like, I can't fix this. It's so much harder here. So they feel unable to solve problems, unable to do the basics. And it's all driven by this fear of self-responsibility, right? Being consistent, keeping promises, that just feels too overwhelming, right? Somehow I'll end up disappointed. So it's easier, it's safer to not try. I saw in lockdown, I've never been busier in my practice, and I saw a lot of folks who I'd worked with through their corporate context, right? So their kind of leadership roles and running businesses and what have you. And then suddenly they were working from home, and it was like worlds colliding of this sense of, you know, home is too much, it's overwhelming. Life admin was overwhelming. So case in point was a woman I worked with who was just brilliant, a corporate lawyer who was living and working in her apartment. And she was like, Saz, I can't open my mail. Like, I'm overwhelmed by the bills that are stacking up. And again, this isn't about capability. It's not about actual, you know, like resources, like financial resources. That wasn't the issue for her. It is easier to not try. I just cannot cope with everything. And as we looked at, you know, what was underneath all of that, for her, she had ended a relationship a few months before lockdown and was on her own for the first time in her adult life. And it was bloody hard, right? It is hard to be a single person and to take on all of those responsibilities. And so this fear of having to be responsible for everything all on her own was just, it just felt too overwhelming. So I think the scapegoat is the one that clients will often find the hardest to share, right? Because there's often a bit of shame attached to it. Like, I should be able to figure this out, or I should know how to cope with all of this stuff. Everyone else has their shit together, right? And there can sometimes be this perception that I'm just feeling sorry for myself, right? When actually, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, but being an adult these days is freaking hard. It is overwhelming. And for us to offer compassion to our clients and help them to figure that out can be incredibly, liberating for them. And, you know, it's often a real, really touching development in the trust and safety within the relationship when our clients can admit some of their kind of secret shames and that kind of thing, which will often sit in this scapegoat area. And I know for me, you know, when stuff gets complex, this is where I go. And I know, you know, for me, this is connected to a childhood where things were totally chaotic and I had to have everything sorted and kind of be the adult. So I have echoes of that when things get too hard. It's like, oh my God, I feel overwhelmed because I go straight back to my kind of little self who was given far too much responsibility, right? So it's all to say, like, this pattern can often make a lot of sense when you start looking at what does it remind you of? You know, when else in your life has this pattern come up? And then we start to look at, you know, what's a really helpful way to intervene. Yeah. But I think it's can sometimes be super helpful for us as coaches to recognize that this is just as much self-doubt as the inner critic. But it's almost the opposite, right? It's a client who is not able to deal with things. But it's not about perfection. It's, you know, it's almost the complete opposite to that. It's actually about, you know, not trying at all. And it's just, and it's a different response to the same driver. You know, don't do that, you might hurt yourself. Anyone want to say anything about the scapegoat if they recognize themselves or clients in this pattern? Yeah, Jane.
Well, I'm almost seeing like, I feel like I do this in a circle. Like I do all of them maybe in different ways. Like if I'm not getting what I need as far as like the critic or avoiding judgment, then I'll go to trying to know more. And if I can't know more or know with certainty, then I just won't do it and feel overwhelmed. And like, I really relate to the like avoiding consistent action and the keeping promises, like that fear definitely shows up in my work. And then I then go to the martyr and go, okay, well, I'll just pour myself into volunteering because then at least I'm worthy in some way.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not supposed to work that way, but I'm seeing that in myself.
No, that's absolutely the case. And, you know, you will often, so I just really want to like reassure you, this is the sign of a sophisticated protective pattern, right? It's I sort of term the phrase like protective pinball, right? That's almost what I see happening when folks say, I relate to all of these. Like, so with pinball, how you're just whacking the flippers and hoping something works. That's almost what your protector is probably doing, right? So whatever you try, it's just going to whack you off into another direction kind of thing. And that can be incredibly discombobulating because it's like, man, where do I start here? And what I would offer is when all of the patterns feel kind of equally present, that starting with the scapegoat can often be a good approach, right? And so we'll talk more about this next week about moving to self-trust. So we sort of move around the compass to intervene. And that's about developing that self-trust. Right. How can I just make the smallest decision possible? How can I make that today? And then, you know, doing that a bit consistently, imperfectly consistently, right? Because the scapegoat is the one that's saying it's all too hard. So that could be a sort of theme around all of it. Yeah. I don't know if that helps you, Jane, just to sort of recognize that. But yeah, with clients who are in that state, it can be tricky to know where to start. So I always suggest the scapegoat. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say it helps to know where to start. If it feels like no matter what you do, it goes somewhere else, then to like at least pinpoint it. Okay, let's work here first.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Angela.
I'm wondering if you have any advice or insight about how to work with someone's scapegoat, and I get that would be part of what we explore. And here's my the reason I want to focus on this, because I noticed that my energy has a really hard time staying neutral when someone's scapegoat is driving the bus, so to speak. I'm like, just move, just do something. And that's a lot of the internal dialogue. It's not necessarily expressed. And I get that it's probably my own inner critic of, you know, that perfectionism. But I'm just curious how. Yeah, if you have any insight on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to also just call out, like, this is exactly what happens, right, is our protective patterns get tangled up with those of our clients.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing we find hard to be with in ourselves, we usually find hard to be with in our clients.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I know for me, I get super frustrated with the scapegoat and other people as well, because I'm like, just do something. It doesn't matter. Like, just crack on, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it does help to look at, where is that coming from? Mm-hmm. Where is it? You know, why is it that that person feels incapable of moving forward? So like I just shared, you know, for me, it's that childhood experience of having too much responsibility. So even just asking your client, what does this remind you of? Mm-hmm. You know, has this happened before? Tell me a bit about taking responsibility for yourself or taking action. Where is that, you know, what have you learned about that? Just kind of talk to me about how that shows up for you. And again, you're just trying to get to know your client. What is going on for them? How are they making meaning around this? What do they make it mean that they have to take a step? You know, what's the protective belief that comes up? And then you can, you know, that will probably give you a thread to pull on, as it were. So, you know, if it's a protective belief, or if it's, you know, it may be too early for them to start taking action. They may just need to look at, why am I not taking action, before they can feel comfortable to actually start that ball rolling. Mm-hmm. Does that help you, Angela?
It does. And I'm seeing how this pattern also shows up a lot in my personal relationships.
Right.
Like, I come from a family of scapegoats, and I have a very similar experience, you know, as a child as you. So I can see this pattern, and then reminding myself of, my job is not to coach my family. You know,
they can just never pay
own my
enough.
Own thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Tina.
Well, I was just thinking about the scapegoat, and like, had we not known this, probably our first inclination would be to talk about accountability and motivations and just kind of assume this person needed their, you know, act cleaned up. But I think that would be just so horrible, because that would reinforce everything like that they've already experienced, you know? So it's just so good, because we can have compassion for, like, we do need to get to the bottom of the story. It's not as simple as make a plan and show up for yourself and, you know, muscle through it or whatever.
Yeah. I'm always really suspicious of anyone who calls themselves a kick-ass coach.
Yeah.
Ooh. it doesn't sound like my kind of coach. Yeah. For exactly that reason, right? And I think it's just that thing of when you can take a step back and sort of see, well, why is this happening? If we always assume this is going on for a really bloody good reason. Our clients are not doing this just to piss themselves off, right? Or stomp on their own dreams. They're doing this for a really good reason. So what? I wonder what that might be, right? And we may get to the bottom of that in a session, and we may not. But the idea is to reassure them, you know, this isn't happening by accident. It's okay. And we will figure it out. So sometimes if you take the pressure off the idea that somehow they do have to, as you say, like, clean their act up and get a plan, right? Like, most of us know how to make a plan, right? That's not that hard to do. What we don't know is, well, why don't we stick to the plan? Why don't we actually do the thing, right? Yeah. Great insight, Tina. Yeah.
I was just going to jump in quickly. Sorry, Hannah.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm fascinated by this conversation, because I think I'm seeing maybe some of the ways that these archetypes can intersect with, like, neurodiversity. I was like, one of my archetypes is in this sort of scapegoat triad. And I was like, I see it, but I also recognize that because I have ADHD, I have, like, very strong initiation energy. I'm, like, really good at starting. And I'm, as we're talking, I'm like, oh, for me, it's almost like my scapegoat got sophisticated and, like, moved the inaction, like, a couple steps down the journey. So it's harder to see. I'm like, oh, I'm taking the first step, not hard. Taking the, like, fourth step, that's where things get tricky. And that, I think it's just been interesting to hear this conversation of, like, I think there's something about probably complexity there that, like, in the blissful ignorance of not knowing how complicated something might be, I'm like more than willing to dive in. And then the second I see it, I'm like, ooh, no, thank you. Yeah. But it's interesting to be like, oh, I don't feel a lot of resistance to just starting something. It's the continuing that feels risky.
Yeah, I think that's such a great insight and into your own approach, right? And so it's like, oh, so now when you're starting a new thing, it's almost like, can you prepare for when you might experience that sense of overwhelm? And how might you support yourself, right? Because you have incredible self-awareness around, you know, what's going to happen. So it's like, how can you then resource yourself so that if you do get to a place where it feels overwhelming or the complexity hits, you know, what can you do to you know, help yourself out and offer yourself some compassion rather than the pattern can sometimes be start, quit, start, quit, start, quit, lots of different things, right? Sort of almost like, you know, the shiny object syndrome, I think we call it, right? The next thing will be the thing, when actually it's like, oh, it's the pattern I'm engaging in that's showing me there is a way I need to intervene here differently. That's how I'll finish the thing. We'll also talk more about this, Adrienne, when we get to module 10 around this approach I've developed for goals. And that from coaches who have gone through the program who are self-identified as neurodiverse, they've said this has been the thing that's made the difference. So it very much takes into account, you know, that none of us follow a bloody plan in a straight line, right? So I think putting these two things together might help as well. Yeah. Cool. Great insight. All right. Hannah.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about this one. Like I'm thinking about a friend in a specific example, but she was really overwhelmed at the thought of going freelance because she was like, I just won't be able to do the accounting. It's so hard. And that felt like the big thing. And I was just thinking, there's like, maybe two beliefs at play. There's kind of the belief about the task itself, like that's too big or too complex, and then there's the belief maybe about your ability to handle it.
Yeah.
Does that sound right? Like that there's maybe the two things to look at, or
yeah completely. And you know, usually it is how these protective patterns can team up as well, right? I don't know enough, so I can't start. And it's too complex, so I can't finish. So it kind of, we end up getting in the mix of that and going, what's a bloody point? Which is a totally understandable response, really. But it's because we've got stuck in that way of thinking and don't see that, well, what else could be true? What other options might I have for how I approach this? Yeah. Cool. Sal?
Firstly, I love Adrienne's comment, the scapegoat triad. It makes me want to read that book or watch the or write that book. I love this idea of the protective patterns teaming up, because this is what's really hits. And I'm starting to wonder if I am undiagnosed ADHD, which is something I've been thinking for a while, and what Adrienne just said sort of sent some shivers down the spine. But what I'm noticing is that my martyr in my other business and my parenting is really helpful. It sort of bolsters my bystander and scapegoat. It feels like they all kind of plot together. It feels not the inner critic so much, although I see that in some ways, but the other three have really got a strong team in place. We'll keep her busy and distracted over here, which kind of helps. It seems like the bystander almost delegated some roles, if that makes sense.
Ah, that makes so much sense. Yeah. Mm. So the bite, because the bystander, which we'll come on to, is all about waiting. Wait till you know enough, right? So what better to do while you're waiting, right, than feel needed and, you know, get some love that way, get some feeling of you know, connection that way. So yeah, that is a very sophisticated approach to this stuff, and it's all about holding you back from what feels what the real thing is that you want to do that feels risky.
And maybe we can talk more about it on the forum, or I can bring it to study group. But with the client, if you're really struggling to pin down one face, how important is that? And is it enough to figure out the underdoing, overdoing? Can that at least get you
down absolutely. The path from that? Absolutely. And I think your client's going to give you some clues, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the, you know, in these patterns is, you know, listening for those, the sense of the what's being overplayed, right? So with the critic, it's overworking at something. With the master, it's overgiving. With the scapegoat, they feel overwhelmed. And with the bystander, they're overthinking. I'm amazed I remembered all of those. And so, you know, you're just listening out for what's being overplayed, what feels like disproportionately present for the client. And that will help you to sort of... The critic is overworking.
Overworking. Thank you. They're really helpful.
And it's just like a way in. So then you can kind of test your thinking. Now, what's going on for you around this? And yeah, say more. So you're just gathering a bit of insight and information from the client. Let them share with you sort of where they're at. And then when it comes to looking at, well, you know, what should we do about this? then you've got, you know, a bit of an idea of where to go. But it, as, you know, Tina was saying before, like, what we don't want to do is, you know, give someone who is in that, trapped in that scapegoat pattern, more things to feel overwhelmed about, right? And we don't want to give someone who's stuck in the critic pattern more things to do, right? We actually want to try and intervene in a different way. So that's where you start to kind of look at more sophisticated interventions and experiments to play with.
Thank you.
And, you know, I'm sure you know this, Al, but I think there are so many folks I know at the moment our age who are discovering, oh, my goodness, here's a piece of the jigsaw of me that I just didn't have before. And I think neurodiversity, as we know more about this and how often it's misdiagnosed, particularly in women and girls, I think, yeah, so such a great gift to give yourself, even to rule it out. You know?
Yes, yeah, no, it's coming up more and more in different contexts. It's made me think, oh, yes, thank you.
Yeah, you're so welcome. Cool. So let's move on to number four. The fourth one is the bystander. For folks in this bystander pattern, it's all about waiting. That's where safety is. Just wait, right? And so what you might hear a client talk about is feeling confused, feeling like, I just don't know. I don't know what to do. I don't know how I feel. I don't know what I think. I don't know, right? Or they can equally be a bit focused on a fantasy future, right? Once I know this, though, it's all going to be gravy. Right. Once I figure this out, my business is going to explode, or I will make this money, or I will achieve this goal, or whatever. Like, there's a sort of fantasy, magical thinking element to it. But the core belief of the bystander is, I just don't have enough information. I don't know enough. And so they get stuck in overthinking, either in research or standing on the sidelines, watching everybody else, comparing. But there's a sense of being unable to act, right? Unable to take action. And so this is driven by the fear, whatever I do might be wrong. So I don't want to make the wrong choice. I don't want to fail, and I don't want to look foolish. Right? So it's all, safety is all about, I just wait. So it's the freeze response. Just wait. Then I won't do anything wrong. And the bystander and the scapegoat are the underfunctioning protective patterns. All right, so they're much more comfortable in thinking and feeling. The critic and the martyr, much more comfortable in doing, in action. Yeah, that's where it feels safest. Anyone recognize themselves in that bystander pattern? Yeah, Hannah, Jane, yeah, Sal, yeah. It's a good one, right? So, it's so effective. I think, you know, I have a real soft spot for the bystander, because it's like, nobody move, nobody gets hurt. It's, you know, it's the Hootie and the Blowfish of protective patterns. It's, you know, so, so helpful. Really sophisticated. It's almost like the simplest thing to do. And I see this a lot with business owners. And the business owners that I tend to work with almost inevitably tend to be coaches by and large. But there is this kind of partnering that will sometimes happen between the bystander and the critic, right? So I think, Jane, you mentioned that before, right? I'm going to wait until it's perfect. Just, you know, that's my approach, which is, you know, to me, I just think it's bloody genius, really, because you are absolutely going to protect yourself from pretty much all the risks by taking that approach, right? So our protectors are just so sophisticated, right? It's really effective. So for any of you who are just like, oh, that's me, you know, it is genius. And so the way out of that is to try something new. Anyone want to say anything about the bystander or how that shows up for you in different contexts, perhaps?
Yeah, I think for me, it's definitely the fallacy of like, okay, once I've researched and studied enough the perfect strategy, then it will all be nailed. Or like, I also have it with stuff like exercise. I'm like, oh, once the winter's here, like it'll be much easier because it won't be as hot. But then in the winter, I'm like, oh, once the light evenings are here, it'll be way easier to exercise because I won't be like so tired in the evening. So like, it's always putting stuff off and always definitely like fantasizing about this like ideal scenario that will never like kind of come to being probably.
Meanwhile, you never have to exercise, right? Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Adrian and Kelly, I think I saw you put your hands up earlier.
I really resonate with this one. It's like, I'm just going to do a little bit more research and I'm just going to see what they're doing over there and compare myself a little bit and think, oh, maybe I need to know a little bit more before I start. And then there's a sprinkling of the critic, the inner critic, and there's a sprinkling of the scapegoat as well. So it's like, might as well just do nothing.
Brilliant. Exactly. I mean, and I think when you start to see, oh, it's just this pattern that I'm locked in, right? It's not a personality description. Like none of these are, this is who I am, right? It's not a psychometric thing. It is a pattern that we're just repeating. And the thing about patterns is you can change those patterns if you want to and want to try that out. But yeah, it's clear. It's genius.
It's funny, this conversation is reminding me, a couple years ago, I had a conversation with my best friend and I was like lamenting that I never did anything. And she was like, let me give you a list of all of the things that you've done recently. great friend. And I was like, yeah, but that's like 10% of the ideas that I've like brought to completion. And was thinking about how like much of a cognitive load it is to be like, I have this like 90% of things that I'm aware that I have like wanted to do or take action on and haven't, and like have been stuck in this pattern, and how totally invisible that was to somebody who knows me really well. And sort of the cognitive dissonance that was created when she was like, here's my perception of you. Like, no, like totally neutral and like encouraging. And for me to be like, whoa, that feels so different from how I'm experiencing like my own quote unquote success rate or my own ability to like see things through or to take action in general, whatever. So I'm seeing how my like bystander and scapegoat and critic are all like neatly operating in lockstep too.
Completely. Like I can totally see like if the critic is saying, in order for your execution rate to be perfect, you have to make sure that every idea gets delivered, then that's incredibly overwhelming and you're going to feel like you're not doing enough. So yeah, there's a really interesting theme, I think, for folks in that pattern of particularly the critic and the bystander, where it's an interesting relationship often with commitment that plays out. Like how do I commit to things and see things through? And what are the beliefs that show up around all of that? Yeah. And it's how sobering is it when someone says, well, let me tell you what I see, and you trust that person's opinions. Yeah, nice little mirror. Yeah, anyone else want to say anything about the bystander, how that shows up? Cool. Well, these are our four main patterns. What we're going to do next week is talk more about then how to intervene in these. Like I said, you know, we don't want to exacerbate the approach, so we don't want to give the critic more things to do, and we don't want to give the scapegoat more reasons to feel overwhelmed. We want to intervene in a bit more of a thoughtful way. So we're going to talk more about that next week. And what I'd love you to do to sort of prepare for that is give some thought to like your current clients or clients you've worked with over the last year, perhaps if you haven't got a massive load at the moment. And just think about, you know, what are the kinds of patterns of protection that you can see that they may be engaging in? Are they the same as your own? Right, like where is the juicy entanglement likely to be showing up here, which is inevitable, and also what do you know about your clients in terms of the protective patterns that tend to show up for them? It's just going to help us to have a bit of juicy stuff to play with as we go. Sound good? Okay, awesome. What I would offer is when I teach this in self-belief school, people are like, wait, you mean there isn't just an inner critic, there's more, right? And that is both like useful and like welcome information. And sometimes it's like, oh, I've got to choose what I am. And what I will reassure people with a lot is this isn't who you are. This is just the ways that you have the patterns of protection that you've created, the behaviors and the beliefs that have helped you feel safe. So we often kind of need to reassure our clients, this isn't who you are, it's just the ways you've kept yourself safe. But I think, you know, in our world where we like to say, you know, what Enneagram are you and what star sign and what does that mean, it sometimes is a little bit of a head shift for people to see, oh, it's not who I am, it's just the pattern. But yeah. So yeah, give some thought to your own protective patterns, how the context that they show up in, and those of your clients where there may be some crossover. And next week we'll talk more about interventions and experiments and really transforming the hold that the protectors can have on us. Yeah, all good fun. And just a reminder that Scott's study group is on Thursday at the same time as we started this evening at 5 p.m. UK time. Please feel free to pop along to that. And otherwise, I will see you back here, same time, same bat channel, next Tuesday. Yeah. Okay. Take care, loves. Have fun. See you. Bye. Bye-bye.